Welcome to a new episode of Africa with André, where we celebrate Africa one story at a time.
Poaching is a big problem in many parts of Africa. We've all heard about rhinos being poached for their horns that are used in what some people think are an aphrodisiac, or the many years of elephants being poached for their ivory. But did you know that there is even a big business in the poaching of succulents? Yes, those plants with thick, fleshy leaves or parts that store water. During a visit to South Africa in 2024, I had the opportunity to visit Sanborna Wildlife Reserve, where the guide showed us an area that had a variety of unique small succulents, plants that are poached, stolen, and sold so that people can have cute little plants in little pots on their desk. I've invited Paul Forster from Sanborna to chat to us about this. Hi, Paul, and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, André. Thank you very much.
Give us a brief introduction, please. Who is Paul, and tell us about Sanborna?
I am a conservationist at heart, at life and training. Been involved in conservation for 25 plus years. It's a big privilege to be able to live and work in South Africa, in Africa, with the wild things in the wild spaces. And I found myself for the last just about 20 years on Sanborna Wildlife Reserve in the Western Cape of South Africa. Yeah, I've been there since 2003. Can you believe it? There's so many opportunities in the continent and so on. I've spent a little bit of time in Mozambique and in other provinces of South Africa, and I've managed to travel sub-Saharan Africa, not excessively, but I went to explore a little bit, and I ended up in the Karoo. It's about 3 hours from Cape Town. Yeah. And it's an absolute jewel box of biodiversity and endemism, and that's, I think, why I've been there for so long. You know, it's a very exciting project to be a part of. It's so diverse, and after 20 years, we can honestly say that we're still experiencing and learning new things on just about a daily basis.
Yeah, it hasn't been a wildlife reserve forever. I think that's something that you changed. What's the history of Sanborna? You took over cattle land and rewilded it or something like that?
You know, 400 million years ago, this area used to be a shallow sea. And as the waters drained and exposed this landscape, we've got these big mountains here in the Western Cape. We've got quite acidic soils in certain spaces, and that's what established this kind of a fynbos environment. You go from the Cape Peninsula and the coastline, you get into the coastal plain, and then when you go over the mountains into the drier areas, you get to that succulent Karoo space. And yes, being so close to Cape Town, you know, farming development historically in the last couple of hundred years sort of happened from the coast towards the inland. So when we arrived on Sanborna, you know, it was a new project, but the thought was to rehabilitate some of that old farmland to accommodate more of the indigenous and local wildlife species that would have historically occurred there. We're currently 62,000 hectares. We started off with about 54,000 hectares. Yeah. We've managed to expand our footprint, but we were the first to reintroduce free-ranging large animals that would have historically, say, 150 to 300 years ago would have occurred here. Species such as elephants and lions and cheetahs.
And those animals would have been driven out by human settlements in the area, right?
Yes, I think so. There would be a variety of circumstances that would have driven them out. There was competition for resources, I think. You know, there's still human-wildlife conflict across the world at this moment, but yeah. In those days, the animals would have been hunted because it was a source of protein readily available to people moving through the area. Not just farmers, I mean, even before that, you know, the San and the koi hunters, the pastoralists, they would have followed the rainfall pattern. So they would have hunted the animals, but I think fragmentation, probably overuse of species, all those things played a role, changing of habitats for some of the animals. Yeah. In fact, and that's what reduced their numbers over time to the point where there was, you know, none of these large animals left 200 years ago. And that's why it is such an intriguing project to be a part of, because what we attempted was so new. We had to establish it on science, but there was no blueprint to do what we've done in the region. We had to do it in a very sensitive environment. It's a semi-desert system. So we knew that if we didn't do it right, we'd have a lasting negative impact.
A bit of a disaster.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, something that we wouldn't be able to reverse in our lifetimes. So 22, 23 years later, we're still doing research, and I think that's what's so exciting, is we realize how little we actually know about this.
Yeah. Let's dive straight into the poaching issue. generally speaking, what are the main poaching issues in southern Africa? We hear about rhinos. It feels to me like elephants are no longer as big an issue, but I might have that wrong.
Look, I think it's such a broad topic, poaching, because you get subsistence poaching, obviously, and people...
You mean people who are killing animals in order to feed their family?
Yes, you know, people that's okay. Just looking for a source of protein, and that could be anything. You know, it doesn't need to be large species. It could be small little antelope, cane rats. you know, it could be anything, any living thing, or any plant, edible plant for that matter, or anything that's food bearing and so on. And that's very challenging, because we do know that there's a lot of people that live below the breadline and people are struggling to survive. But outside of subsistence poaching, there's poaching for specific organized crime syndicates. You know, that would be something like a rhino horn and I think elephant tusks, even though it's not so publicized, I think that still takes place. You know, ivory is still being traded illegally across the continent. People are media fatigued by poaching and the rhino crisis and that kind of thing. And because it's international networks, you know, it's organized crime, it's linked to money laundering, warmongering, drugs, all sorts of illegal things. And then you get harvesting of plant products and animal products for medicinal uses, traditional medicines, if not close to pharmacies or hospitals. I mean, a lot of our cultures still rely heavily on medicinal plants, and you can't always just go and gather out of the veld like you used to in the old days anymore. So plants do get poached for that purpose. And then there's this very interesting international market, this collector's market, where rarities gets collected. And that's not just restricted to plants, you know, that's as broad as little beetles that only occur above a specific altitude, or rare reptiles, little species that's highly endemic or critically endangered.
Where people want to have them and display this cute little beetle in their hallways as a talking piece when someone comes to dinner.
It's an egotistic thing. It's maybe a, you know, mine's bigger than yours kind of an approach, or look at this new rarity in my collection. And it's a real disgusting but very real threat at this moment in time.
This is fascinating, because I mean, when your colleagues told me that the succulents are being poached, I thought it was a joke, like, you know, poaching is for animals and eggs. But after the conversation with you, it's just so much more complex than I thought. I'll be honest, if you'd said to me someone killed, I don't know, a rat or a small antelope, I wouldn't necessarily have categorized that as poaching. But obviously, if that antelope belongs to Sanbona and it's stolen, then it is poaching. Let's unpack that a little bit. If I look at the subsistence poaching, do you work with the people in the communities or around the reserve to try and reduce that? Is that something that you do alone, or is that something that you do with Cape Nature or somebody else?
I think, you know, the subsistence poaching, if I talk on a national scale, or call it sub-Saharan African scale, something that everybody struggles with. A lot of conservation spaces or game reserves or photographic reserves, they have hard boundaries. On the one side, you'll have a rural development or community that's been there over very many years, where people try to make a living and they do their day-to-day thing. But just through a fence, on the other side, there might be a little bit of buffer zone. But there you've got these landscapes that has natural species occurring in them. And there you see the abundance of proteins running around and all sorts that can really provide livelihood and comfort and shelter and so on to these communities. It used to be a big problem, but there's a real drive in conservation to be inclusive for the communities in that sense. Along these hard boundaries, you often find great partnerships where the communities are involved and they are allowed to harvest in some sort of a controlled space. They benefit differently from a tourism and conservation model than in the old days. So the attempt is not to be exclusive, it's as inclusive as possible. And through that, and job creation opportunities and general regional upliftment, often, you know, the subsistence poaching is not that severe, but you do get it. And that's why there are anti-poaching units constantly trying to remove snares. Certain protected areas and conservation spaces do not have these developments around their boundaries. They're further away, perhaps a bit more remote. And then subsistence poaching is not such a major threat, but that's where you get these really specialized plant and animal species that's then again sought after in the collector's market. But we haven't even spoken about marine resources in poaching. You know, that's another whole topic.
Let's talk about the plants, because that was the impetus for this conversation. So on the one hand, the poaching of medicinal use plants is probably similar to the subsistence poaching of animals. But then the collector's market for the plants, who's coming in and stealing that, and where does that get sent to?
To be honest, the governing conservation body in the region, Cape Nature, and a few other stakeholders are doing incredible work. There are special task forces that's been designed to try to curb this due to the fact that it's linked to other organized crime networks. There's definitely an export market for this. And it's so intricate that some of these little plants, micro succulents, really rare little things that's highly endemic, there might be, you know, three or four populations occurring in one region. And it's so sought after that if we're not vigilant enough, a remote area that's not being protected or patrolled, one of those little populations can be removed in one night. So over a period of a night or two, the poachers can take out a couple of thousand of these little plants, package them for collection later, or they remove them from site right there and then. And then they take them to a facility where they will repackage them and take them to another province, for example, and export them from there in boxes. And then they go out to Asia, to Europe, wherever the delivery market is. And there, from there, they get distributed. These days, social media as well. You can even find sites on the internet that sell these plants. And some of them are grown legally. You need special permits for them and so on. But most of them are harvested illegally. And that's unfortunately where the poachers see the gap. And that's well organized. With well organized networks that's been used to transport either drugs or other illegal contraband or ivory or rhino horn and so on. You know, now they just add a little succulents to it and send it off that way.
But it's crazy that they can clear such big pieces of land in a night.
It depends on what they're looking for. Often the guys walking around in cell phone lights, you know, they just walk around in the felt in some of these arid areas, and they know they've got a specific species they're looking for, and they'll have a tool and pop them out and package them, and there they go. Larger things are being poached now as well, but it's not just South Africa. I mean, Namibia and the deserts of Namibia, a lot of their rare plants and things. There's a market for these rarities, whether it's a baboon spider or a beetle or a reptile or a little beautiful, pretty little succulent plant. Yeah, there's a market.
It's a problem everywhere. It's not something that's unique to Sanborna or unique to the Western Cape. And like you said, yes, I'm having the conversation with you, but there must be so many people working on this together with Cape Nature, law enforcement, so many people working on it together. And we as the good guys need to be one step ahead of the cartels, and that's not always easy.
And also one needs to have political will, and I need to say in context of our national framework at the moment, that political will, it comes from the top. It needs to be classified as priority crimes. And if you're thinking about crimes that we perceive as crimes, you know, armed robberies and murder and those kind of things, that gets attention. But a criminal network that's harvesting plants, I mean, that doesn't really seem like a high priority. But as you say, we spoke about a rat or a small antelope earlier. If we keep on doing this, one thinks, yeah, it's one thing here and it's one little thing there, and, you know, take this and nothing will be noticed. We're losing the battle. Within our lifetimes, definitely, there will be an impact if we don't work together, all stakeholders, whether you're in public, wherever you are, whatever your interests are, we've all got a responsibility to be vigilant and try to protect this natural heritage that we call Mother Nature, because that's what's essentially keeping us on Earth at this moment, you know. If it's not for the natural system, then we won't, as a species, we won't survive. And I mean, we'd be the biggest threat to this planet.
That is true. We are the biggest threat to the planet. I suppose you have men and women who do anti-poaching work. Don't give away any trade secrets, of course, but how are they trained?
You know, this is probably a very apt conversation to have, and I don't know when this will be aired, but today is the 31st of July, and it's World Ranger Day. We commemorate and celebrate the conservationists and field rangers and guides and so on, particularly field rangers, section rangers, regional rangers, as custodians of wild spaces, you know, that spend their time and their effort, whether it's summer or winter, rain, snow, sunshine, they're out there patrolling, trying to protect or keep intact the integrity of these natural spaces. So I've mentioned earlier that there's inclusive community-related work being done at conservation level and landscape level, and we love to employ from our local communities, and very often there's an opportunity for people to pursue a career in conservation as a field ranger or conservationist. These days in tourism, there's a lot of opportunities as well in the hospitality industry and so on. You can be a chef, you can be a housekeeper, you can be a field ranger. We like to develop from within our communities.
And also creates a sense of ownership. This reserve is where I'm getting my job, getting bread, being able to put bread on my family's table. So there'll be an extra level of security against poachers that want to maybe come through the community, right?
Yeah, we hope so. You know, a lot of the field rangers that might be of an older generation now, but when they were little kids, they possibly heard stories being told to them by the fireside of how their fathers or grandfathers used to hunt or roam the land or move from one village to the next or keep their cattle in this location or live off the land there. So it's the best opportunity to actually empower the local people that know the land, ingrained within their beings, that are a part of it, to become protectors of that space as well. Historically, we've tried to recruit people with experience from other conservation areas, and very often they're quite far away from us. And we realized that the people from those areas don't know the culture of this landscape and the history of this landscape and the seasonal changes of this landscape. So it became very important for us to actually go into these communities and select people with the right mindsets and abilities and keenness to develop as field rangers. And that makes up the core of your anti-poaching units, you know. But it's an integration of these law enforcement specialists that focus on environmental crimes together with other stakeholders, together with the technology, together with these people that you develop from within your communities that can assist in, you know, as a team effort to protect the, not just within the confines of one's reserve, but also within the region.
Yeah. What happens when one of your APU staff catches a poacher? I suppose a lot of the work is about preventing it from happening in the first place, as opposed to just trying to catch the poachers. It's about, like you say, deflecting, preventing them, making it less interesting for them to be able to come in and do it in the first place.
I think that's the dream that we have as conservationists. You know, a lot of our colleagues in conservation have become soldiers and law enforcement officers rather than conservationists, and that's often, it's very sad, very challenging.
Yeah, it's not what they wanted initially when they came into the industry.
And we're passionate, so that's what you end up doing. And I think prevention is better than cure in that sense. But if it's such a deep-rooted greed and international organized crime process that drive it, then you know it has to not just happen from bottom up, but from top down as well. There has to be a change, otherwise it's a losing battle.
Have you got any success stories from your APU unit that you can share with us?
Yeah, I think so. It was about 2 years ago. It was just after COVID. We selected some new recruits out of the region, and it's a very interesting selection process. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but you get a couple of hundred candidates that are eager, and you end up with a handful that are actually able. And then from there on, you develop them. And after that, we were approached by our partners in conservation in the region, Cape Nature, and they said, look, they've become aware of certain movements in the region. Would we be able to assist them? And we did assist. It was a joint operation between the South African Police Services and Cape Nature and ourselves. And we managed to arrest a couple of plant poachers in the region. When we managed to, through a few small arrests that we made that night, we unearthed a larger syndicate. But we're a drop in the ocean that's trying to make a difference in our regions.
Well done. You did make a difference. So well done with that.
I think we want to just do the job and not really disclose too much and not really talk about it. But, you know, internally that you've contributed in a way. And I think that's what all of us want to do. So we'll fight the battle quietly on the ground. And if we can get the support from everybody, you know, listening to this.
That's my next question. How do I or the listeners, how can we contribute? How do we help prevent poaching of plants or animals?
I think I mentioned earlier what a strong tool social media is. Obviously, one has to be aware of where you're going to, but if you do the necessary background checks and the correct kind of vetting, there are quite a few organizations that really play a big role in conservation and in anti-poaching and so on. I mean, just an example, Sanbona, you know, we're a non-profit. The land and the project is owned by a non-profit entity. There's no shareholder. So everything that we generate from a hospitality and tourism-based perspective can be plowed straight back into community development, conservation, and regional security and anti-poaching and that kind of thing. So that's the model that we use. It's a very challenging model in its own because conservation is quite an expensive business to be in, but it has to happen. If this tweaks anybody's interest, we can do whatever help we can get within this continent of ours to protect our natural resources, or this world of ours, for that matter.
So that means that even just coming to stay already contributes, because then a portion of what you pay to stay at San Borna will be used for these conservation and community projects.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Give San Borna a plug quickly. There's so many reserves in the country, and classically the first time visitors would want to go to Kruger, but why should someone visit San Borna as opposed to one of the other reserves?
I think what makes us truly unique is we've got 62,000 hectares of open space. It is a semi-desert, so it's a sensitive landscape, but it's got endless views. There's no monotony in the landscape. It's incredibly diverse. It's got a high percentage of endemic species. It's hills upon hills upon hills with deep valleys. It's an ancient landscape, and I think that's one of our unique selling points. We've got three lodges, so we've got currently only 27 rooms across the 62,000 hectares.
Wow, that's a lot of space per person.
Exactly. So it's 54 beds if we work it out. Yeah. So there's more than 1,000 hectares of space per guest that come to us. Our values are to conserve and to connect and to aspire. So we challenge ourselves internally to live those values on a daily basis across all aspects of our business. We want to tread lightly. We want to really leave it in a better state than we found it.
Paul, we're almost at the end, and I like to finish my episodes with questions about favorites. So first of all, what is your favorite spot on the San Borna Reserve?
There are many. I mean, you can be in the low-lying areas there in the river lines, but then you can be on a ridge and you know that you're in the succulent karoo or in the clang karoo because of these vistas and views. And in all of those spaces, you feel a breeze over your skin or the sun on you. So it's hard for me to say, you know, the whole space is a favorite. I love that area. I didn't know it would have such a big impact on my life. So I can't, let's just say that whole space.
These ridges with the endless views, that's very, very special. Maybe the next question is a little bit easier. What's your favorite animal and why?
I love brown hyenas. I really do. I wish I could see them more, but you have to be nocturnal to see them. And we are in many cases, but then they're quite elusive as well, so they disappear quite quickly.
What is it about them that you like?
They're elusive. They're well adapted. They're harsh. They're quite gentle, I think, as well. I think they're often misunderstood. But they're quite powerful, and they're so well adapted. You know, they can survive in harsh environments, and they capitalize on any opportunity. They're successful hunters, but they can scavenge, and they're strong. There's a lot that people don't often appreciate of them because they associate with them being carrion eaters and dirty and scruffy and so on.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us and giving us more insight into the conservation work of your reserve, San Borna, but also Cape Nature and the challenges that there are and how you are working against it.
Thank you, Andre, for creating the opportunity to contribute to create awareness, because it's such important topics. One can talk about these for very many days, not just minutes or an hour. So hopefully you reach an audience that this can tickle some interest in. And thanks for that opportunity. I really appreciate that.
You're very, very welcome. Paul did tell me about further anti-poaching success stories in other areas in the country that San Borna was involved in, but for obvious reasons, I've chosen not to include that information. About 2 weeks after this interview took place, Paul forwarded me some news articles about poachers that were sentenced, so justice does happen. I'll add links to those articles into the show notes for you. San Borna is involved in several conservation projects, including one with cheetahs, and the reserve is also an impact player in a project that is focused on the Cape Mountain zebras. This works to ensure genetically diverse populations of these zebras within the reserve and in the broader region. It was wonderful to see Paul get so excited when he spoke about the success of this project. I found it fascinating to learn about plant poaching, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode as well. Let me know what you thought. I'd love to get a message from you. podcast@africawithandre.com. Until the next time.